Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts in Norwood. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. We could be your tribe, Dan. We could be the tribe that changes your life. If they ever allow us to open again.
In the distant future. Phase 3?
Star Log, May 22nd, 2020.
Yeah. And I think they said the only news, COVID news from last week, is they introduced these phases of reopening.
Right.
I think the gym owners weren't totally happy to be in phase 3.
That's what it looks like.
They named it. It was like phase 1 is called cautious. Phase 2 is like distant. I don't know. Phase 3 is like bleak. And phase 4, I think, is called unattainable. I'm not positive about these names.
Phase 4, they use a term which I've come to not appreciate, new normal.
The new normal?
Yeah. I think they said cure and vaccine will be phase 4, which is, I don't think they should do that. I mean, that's something that's very uncertain. Well, what I did like, Dan, is they had some criteria for moving through the phases. And did you see it on the webpage? And they got like, you know, number of positive tests, number of deaths, I think, number of hospitalizations. And they got green, yellow, or red or something. And we're all in green and yellow so far. But what I didn't like is they didn't tell you how do you go from yellow to green. What's the exact number they're looking for?
Oh, so yeah, I didn't think there were numbers.
Yeah, why aren't they giving? They have a freaking number, Dan. Why aren't they giving us the number? Because we're
maybe
stupid
they don't have
taxpayers.
Maybe
they
don't. And they're like, I want to keep this sort of open and so I can make my decision when I want.
Yeah.
You know, so I can feel the pulse of the people.
Right.
That's what I guess for politicians, right? They're like, let me just feel the pulse. And when it feels like I can move on, I'll move on. Like, I'm not going to be the first. I'm not going to be the last. Or maybe I am going to be the last, depending on the state.
Right.
But they're like, I'm going to wait.
I heard somebody use this metaphor. It's a little bit like there's a bunch of penguins on the edge of the ice floe, and they're looking in the water, and there may be like a sea leopard in there. And one of them jumps in and the other penguins watch to see if he gets eaten alive or he gets a little fish for himself. If he starts, things go well for him, then more start jumping in.
And so, that's what's that? Yeah. That's
pretty much
society
what's happening,
now.
Right? That's these governors now. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. And mayors or whatever.
Because people aren't reopening. You don't hear people really giving hard numbers like we dipped below 20% and so now I'm going to open, you know, or it's been 14 days of below 10% new infection. Like, you don't hear specifics. You sort of hear.
Well, it was supposed to be about flattening the curve. So then the numbers that matter would be hospitalizations and ICU bed use. And I think that's in there. Just give us a range.
Yeah.
Like, once it's under 500 in the ICU, we're going to go to phase 2 or phase 3 or whatever.
Right. Because I haven't heard the term flatten the curve in a month, you know, from a public figure.
Right.
You know, so it seems to be that's not.
They moved on to that. That was a very convincing argument to start the whole ball rolling.
Yeah. And the only problem is when that goal keeps moving, like I heard it was John Oliver talking about the UFC and MMA.
Yeah.
And he used a term where he was like, you know, he's generally very kind of sarcastic. And he was just sort of rolling his eyes and he was like, obviously, I think he was mentioning Jacare and his cornermen testing positive. And he's like, it's the clearest evidence. You obviously can't do this without risk. He said something
like that.
That's
what he said. He goes, yeah. First of all, the UFC, they did multiple testing. Yeah. They basically created the safest sporting event that's ever occurred in the history of the planet.
But I also think it worked. They
totally
did three events. They caught the guys that were positive.
Three guys were positive.
There's no reports of anyone. If it's spreading.
Dan, it's a net positive. Those three guys might not have known that they had it.
Yeah.
Now they knew they had to quarantine themselves and protect people around them. I mean, it was a boon to the world at large.
But also, it's been weeks. Like, it's clear.
Yeah,
that
I would like to ask John Oliver, so what was the downside? What horrible thing happened? And then, Dan, I know it's exactly what you're saying.
But
he said risk. And they obviously were working, and they can't do it until there's no risk.
Yeah.
No risk.
Saying, that's what I was going to get to. Like, that's the new goalpost. Like, no risk.
No risk.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist. I mean, he's an idiot. I mean, that's the other thing. Give some guy some sort of British accent. of some sort. And then all of a sudden, Americans think he's 50 IQ points higher than he really is. But he
I was, do too, though. I
he
find
was
that too.
Way off on that UFC criticism.
Also, I mean, funnier, by the way. British or Irish accent, I think. I think Irish accent more charming.
I guess, but
smarter and funnier. I fall for it too.
I thought he was way off on that. Yeah, and you nailed it right there.
Yeah.
He used the word, like, he didn't say unreasonable risk. Yep. He didn't say excessive risk. He said risk. That's it. Right. That's the new standard. You can't do anything that involves a risk.
Oh, and maybe for the listeners, as a quick side point, that UFC is now, if you have ESPN Plus, it's now free. The first pay-per-view that came out. Like, remember I told you 2 weeks later, they're all out?
Is that how it is?
Yeah. Nice. So if anyone didn't get the pay-per-view, it's out now. Like Tony Ferguson, what's his name? Gaethje fight. And it was a good event. That's free on ESPN Plus. So just another service from this podcast letting you know that you can watch it now.
Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
They have another event on the 30th, I think, right?
Yeah, it's 2 weeks now. We got to wait, though, right?
8 days.
Oh, 8 days?
Yeah.
Okay. Do they have, if they have one on the 30th?
That's the last time I looked at it. Okay. I don't know. I hope so. I think it's Woodley versus Gilbert Burns, maybe. Should be a great fight. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll go Woodley.
Yeah, probably, but probably. I haven't seen him fight in a long time. I'm excited to watch it.
Yep.
Yeah. I think the UFC, I think Dana White did the whole country a service by putting that thing together the way he did, man.
Something to watch.
Yeah.
We've done that. That's another service this podcast has done, things to watch. We've given advice. Did you watch the Michael Jordan special yet?
I did.
The Last Dance?
Yeah. Did you watch it?
Yes. Did your microphone just shut off?
Yeah. This thing is like so temperamental. Is it working?
Now it does. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't touch it.
So I wanted to ask you about, so the very last episode, this is not a spoiler, although, okay, spoiler alert, he wins.
He wins the championship?
Yeah, he wins the last one. Yeah. So I don't want to ruin that for those who didn't know, but they were talking about, like, they were wrapping up the whole thing. And so this is like in the sweet spot, I think, of this podcast.
Yep.
And there's a guy right literally at the wrap up of the final episode. And he says, Michael Jordan's gift wasn't that he could jump higher and run faster and whatever else. He said his gift was that he always lived completely in the present. He never worried at all about the future. So one quick aside, we both know, and everyone listening and everyone that watched Michael Jordan knows, that's not his only gift. Like, he also was an incredible physical specimen.
Right. And that's just nonsense. Anyways, nobody always lives in the present moment. That's silly. That's like some new agey goofiness, because how are you going to know what game we're playing next week? Oh, we're playing this team tomorrow. Yep. Yeah, you're not living always in the present moment. That's just silly.
Right.
Yeah, it's an exaggeration.
But is there any element of truth to it, where, because the follow-up quote was something like, if you asked him, like, are you worried about missing a shot? He'd be like, why would I ever worry about missing a shot that I haven't taken yet? Now, so that's what I'm asking. Do you think this is all poetry? And nothing really to do with that?
No, I think there's something to it. I think what they really mean to say is, when he's performing basketball, when he's competing, he's completely in the moment. And he's not thinking, can I make this? What are people going to think about if I don't make the shot? There's no energy being expended on those thoughts. So when he's playing basketball, I believe he's 100% in the moment.
And you preach that, exactly that, for jiu-jitsu all the time, right? Like,
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
So, and for the same thing, maybe the night before, you don't have to be in the moment then. You can be practicing or thinking it through, or planning or going over your game plan. Right. But when you're rolling,
or manufacturing some insult or slight somebody did against you so you can get all fired up.
Right. But when you're rolling or fighting in MMA or whatever you're doing, try to as best you can banish all thoughts of, what if I embarrass myself? What if I lose? Right. Who's watching me?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great, all the great athletes seem to have that, right? I think we've talked before about Tom Brady's great example of that, right? Like, it is so almost unhuman to be down 28-3 at the end of the third quarter. And I really believe Brady has this like bizarre ability to be like, we're going to come back, we're going to win.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching it going like, yeah, they're done. right? Like, you know, I know there's fans that'll be like,
I didn't.
Let's go.
I definitely didn't, Dan. And, you know, here's the thing I think about Brady and the Patriots is I believe this about Brady. When they get down, it's in a sense, it's a little bit easier for him in that they're just going to open up the offense now.
They go to the hurry up and they start.
And he can take all these chances. He's going to get a ton of throws. He knows. He's like, if you let me throw the ball enough, I'm going to score some touchdowns. Yeah. So I might not win the game, but I'm going to have fun. I'm going to move the ball. We're going to get things, get something done here. You know, if you're up by four,
you're handing off. And
then, you know, we're managing the clock. They're slowing it all. There's all this shit going on you know what I mean? It's not allowing him to express himself the best.
And even during the 28-3 comeback, he threw an interception. Like, it wasn't a pure...
Oh, right.
Right, like, and he just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. I also remember, if you want to go back further, Joe Montana, he had that famous drive where, Steve Largent caught it? Or I can't remember now, but like... I just remember the famous drive where, to win the game, you know, the clock winded
down. Tight end
down.
Catches it, you mean, in the end zone?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Steve Largent. I forget.
It wasn't, right? Yeah. It was another thing. But during that drive, they were, you know, some Joe Montana special, and they said, you know, they were at the 50-yard line or something. And in the huddle, you know, they're all, like, amped up. One of his players was relaying the story. And Joe Montana's like, guys, I think that's John Candy sitting right there. And like, they all look over and it's like John Candy in the stands. And he's like, how about that? Anyway, and like, goes on with it. And it was like, this guy is not, I mean, like, he's totally.
Is that more related to his IQ, you think? Or
to me, it's, to me, there might be a component there. Like, not. And it's also, in a way, it also sounds like he got distracted and like wasn't. But it's also.
But he's not self-conscious.
Yeah,
that's
he's not
point.
Like, oh, I'm gonna throw an interception. I'm gonna call the wrong play. He's just like totally relaxed. It's just crazy to think more relaxed than people in the stands. People watching on TV are like more nervous than these guys in the arena.
So cool.
It's sort of superhuman. I think Jordan had that too.
Yeah, I think so. And it's about self-consciousness. Right? They're in the moment, but they're lacking self-consciousness. But he's also, he gets distracted, but he's not distracted by like, oh shit, I better make this next pass. I got to make this. I can't miss that out or whatever the hell it is, you know? So yeah, that is definitely a big deal. You know, I was listening to an interesting podcast this week with the author Michael Lewis. You familiar with him?
Yes.
Yeah. Great writer, right? Liar's Poker. Did he write The Big Short probably too?
I think so.
All kinds of stuff. Just a great writer. Oh, Moneyball was another big one that he wrote. So anyways, I was listening to him and he was talking about this other guy, Tim Galway, who wrote this book called The Inner Game of Tennis in the 1970s. And he was a tennis coach and he sort of stumbled upon this method. And what the method is basically what you're talking about is getting people to not feel self-conscious. So he would be training, you know, he was at like some local club training people how to play tennis and giving them technical instruction, and people would struggle. And then he just got tired of doing it that way and just sort of on a whim just went the other way. He just gave them almost no instruction. And then he found that they were progressing faster because they weren't self-conscious. They weren't thinking, hold the racket like this, turn your body, step. And he had great success. And then he wrote this book. I think they said it sold 2 million copies from the 1970s, The Inner Game of Tennis. But one of the other things, he ended up coaching people in all these other fields that he had no expertise in. Because that type of the coaching was almost like a energy coach. You know how we were talking about big cat energy for last? It's about that. Like I realize you have the technical side of instruction, but you also have kind of this, so you might call energy side. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I actually think that's tailor-made for jiu-jitsu, right? Because I definitely would have periods where I could feel I was suffering from trying to think through. Mm. Remember the early days of jiu-jitsu where there was a lot more instruction that was like, hand here, posture here. Like, there was a lot more like, now you grab the
step
by step through different things. And it would be very clunky. And I'd be like, wait, am I my left foot now? Or the, like, grab the key? And I definitely would feel there has to be something more to make this smoother. And it sounds exactly like that.
Did I mention this quote by Ryan Hall last week where he said, jiu-jitsu is more of a sense than a series of instructions. Yeah, and that's exactly it. So the one story he has is he went to the Houston you know, symphony orchestra or something, and he was coaching them, and he gave some presentation, and the conductor was like, yeah, that sounds great. Like, he wasn't impressed. Anybody have anything they want to ask him? And the tubist said, I'm having a hard time hitting some certain note. And he goes, I try to listen for it, and I can't quite do it. And this guy, Tim Galway, goes, we'll try it now. And the guy tries it. And the guy, Galway, knows nothing about music. And he goes, oh, how was that? And he goes, not good. And then he says, well, how did you feel in your body when you're playing it? And he goes, I don't know. My tongue felt kind of dry. And he goes, okay, why don't you try it again, but just try to concentrate on your tongue staying moist while you do it. And then he does it again, and he gets a standing ovation. And this guy, Tim Galway, he doesn't know that, he can't hear the difference, but apparently everyone else is like, right, oh my God, that was amazing. So that was sort of his trick, is to get people, you might say, out of their own head, get them off self-consciousness. And to get out of self-consciousness, you almost have to get away from that sort of analytical, technical perspective, you know what I mean? Where I got to turn my wrist over here, I got to do this. You would think that would get me there, but sometimes you got to just come up with something completely different, you know?
Right. So, two sides of it. One is, I definitely felt that. A good example, probably there's a lot of examples, but a good example is passing the guard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes where it's like, you can be shown, especially in early days, you can be shown five different passes and struggle with all of them.
Yeah.
And do better if you're told something like, get your knee next to his hip, however,
right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
get around the legs, however you can do it.
Right.
That's also why it's very common in jiu-jitsu, and I'm sure you'd attest to this, you must see it all the time, where people almost go backwards. Like, athletic young guys can come in and be good, and then they're sort of overthinking about all the moves, and suddenly, like, they can't pass as well.
Right. Yeah. Right? That's typical. Yeah.
The only thing is, it's not quite that easy, right? It's also, you have to find
the balance. Well, if you want to get to that third level, right, you have to go through that technical level. Yeah. You need, I couldn't hand you a tuba and say, Dan, think of keeping your tongue moist.
Right.
You're going to suddenly
play tuba.
Someone
better show me the technique.
Yeah. Right. You definitely need,
you're guessing
aspects
on that, by the way, but we have no proof that I couldn't do it.
And somebody can't sit down on a chessboard and you just say,
right,
imagine you're a jaguar, and like, you don't even know how to move the pieces. So, right. And I think jiu-jitsu is actually very, very technical at the highest level of competition. So you need all the technique for sure. But there's some people that probably need to improve their energy.
Right. And that's what takes 10 years or more, right? To be like, I'm doing the things technically correct and it feels normal to me. I'm not thinking that much about each one. I'm not.
Well, I think what happens is, maybe with a guy like Michael Jordan, or in jiu-jitsu, Gordon Ryan is a big, you know, champion now. Like, he seems to be on top of the heap, and Gary Tonin is his training partner. They do really well. I think maybe when you love something so much, like we talked about, Marcelo Garcia says, nobody loves jiu-jitsu as much as I do. And Gordon's handle on Instagram is Gordon Loves Jiu-Jitsu. So if you love something so much that you immerse yourself in it and you get a high level of technical proficiency, then you probably never feel self-conscious. You know what I mean? Like, just your love and your level just forces you to transcend any sense of doubt or hesitation or self-consciousness, right?
Right.
So when they're like, yeah, Jordan, he was always present. Yeah, because he freaking loves basketball, and he knows push comes to shove, he's better than everybody in the court. So it's going to be easy to stay focused then. But he's not that much better. You know what I mean? He's got to, like, apply himself to be the best, you know? Right. I talk about energy. When I was watching that, there was one play where, you know, he breaks toward the basket. He's driving to the basket, and he's got an easy layup, right? He's on the sort of his right side of the basket, and he goes up. Instead of just laying it up, he swings his arm around and throws it in with his left hand from the other side of the hoop. And it's like, well, that was completely unnecessary for him to do that. But now I'm thinking, but just that flourish keeps him in that energy flow, that mojo, you know what I mean? That keeps him in that flow where you're doing, like, almost stylized movements that don't seem like they're necessary, but they keep you in that flow. I mean, if he just came in and he did a little layup, because he broke through the defenders, there's no defender near him, then maybe that wouldn't give him the flow that he was looking for. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's other times where you do need to switch, like if there's a defender
right
there
around him. And now you can do it because you're doing it all the goddamn time anyways, right?
Right.
Yeah. Very cool. I got a lot out of watching that The Last Dance. Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. Here's what another thing I got out of it, Dan. I got a greater appreciation for team sports. And this is going to take a little bit for me to explain it, because when I started watching it, I thought of this selfish gene, this concept we talk about a lot, like the selfish gene, where we're, as human animals, we're sort of in a competitive race all the time. And we want to get our genes to mate with the fanciest genes that we can find. And I think at that time, and it probably still happens in sports, pro sports, is Michael Jordan became a symbol of the fanciest genes on the planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, people would look at him and go, look at that goddamn guy. He's handsome. Look at the way he moves. He's a champion. He's got the fanciest genes on the planet. And then, well, we want to have the fanciest, so then we're going to buy his shoes. Like, that Gatorade commercial was, be like Mike. And that's it. Be like the fanciest genes on the planet.
Is that even, does everyone remember that? Like, do kids, young kids today know about be like Mike?
I don't know. Maybe that's gone.
I don't know.
Kind of a bit of genius for an ad, wasn't it? And but it's sort of like summed it all up for me. Like, the phenomenon of Michael Jordan is he was kind of like, you know, Miss Universe. He's like the most pretty, popular human on the planet.
The most famous, yeah, and the most popular, the most famous.
But
yeah.
Why is he the most famous? You know, it's not conscious, but at an unconscious level, he's got the best genes right now of any human on the planet. And there's something about that I don't find as noble as a team coming together, a group of people, and performing, you know, above their competition, who maybe is superior physically to them. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So you're saying you have an added appreciation to the team aspect of a team victory.
Yeah.
Over, sure, like an individual.
Yeah. But we're fascinated as humans, I was going to say in our culture, but I think it transcends our culture, with who's got the fanciest genes. Like, even take a New England Patriots, right? Well, it's Brady. Well, it might be Belichick. People still are trying to parse out who has the superior genes, who is responsible for these championships. Maybe it's Gronk. Maybe it's Brady. Maybe it's Belichick. You know what I mean? They don't say, oh, it's this amazing team that came together. And I think, if you think about it, Dan, especially in football, you have so many people coming together. People come together, you know, share responsibility, work hard, coordinate themselves so they can beat a superior force. I mean, that's pretty noble. I mean, can you elevate human experience more than that?
Right. And it's the added, for someone like Brady or Jordan or Joe Montana, like, they have an added. So for combat sports, there's all this strategy to optimize yourself.
Right.
And to bring your performance to its optimal capability.
Yeah.
With the team sports, there's this added sort of feature you have to have of, can you bring everyone up around you? And a lot of Last Dance was about that with Jordan, like,
yeah,
different ways of doing it. Like, there's no similarity at all of how Michael Jordan motivated his teammates versus how Tom Brady motivates his teammates, right?
You don't think so?
I think Jordan was angrily yelling and berating them and, you know, firing them up and challenging them. Whereas I think Brady is like, nice guy.
I think Brady's got a little of that. I think part of it is you're setting a standard for practice and game performance.
You did always hear that Brady was the first one out, and, you know, they'd be like, oh, it's freezing rain outside. And he'd be like, let's go, and like, be the first one out the door, even when he was 40 years old, you know? So
I think all the greats, Larry Bird, all those guys are sort of like that. You know who I was impressed? I don't really know enough about basketball, but Magic Johnson seems like a guy who could turn it off. Like, Jordan had that ruthless, competitive nature.
All the time.
All the time. And, like, he really couldn't shut it off, it seemed like. Even in this, he's looking back decades, and he's still pissed off about stuff, right?
Yeah, he never turned it off.
He can't turn it off. That's who he is, right? It's more limited dimension. I don't want to say he's one dimensional. I'm sure, you know, he's not, but it's limited dimension. Then you get a guy like Magic, who, like, they both have great smiles, but when Magic smiles, it's like he really has more compassion almost. He means it, right? Like, he's trying to win in the worst way possible. And I'm sure he practiced just as hard and everything, you know,
super competitive when he's on the court. Yeah.
But then he can kind of, like, turn it off a little bit. And, like, remember they had that that moment when they were having a practice game, the Dream Team, and Jordan finally got pissed off and went off and scored a bunch of points. And then they had all this hostility. And then Magic was the one that broke the tension by saying, I guess we shouldn't have pissed the man off, right?
Right, right. Whereas Jordan has no side. He would never have made that joke. Like if his team had lost.
I don't think he could pull it off, right? Yeah.
I think it never stopped. I heard a thing that wasn't on the special that even as like the GM of the Washington basketball team, not the Bullets now, what are they, the Generals or whatever they became?
I don't know what they are here.
They, Charles Barkley as an analyst was like saying Michael made some bad trades or is not, you know, not doing the best job with the personnel on his team. And, Jordan ended their friendship, and they've been friends like 20 years or whatever it is at that time. They used to golf together.
Probably 30 years, right? Yeah. Crazy,
and
right?
And just like, you know what I mean? That he's ruthless all the time.
Yeah.
No one tells stories that no one is like, there's this other side to Mike where he's not ruthless. You know, like even everyone in the special tried to say good things about him, but no one said, oh, he's not like that at all off the court.
Yeah, I don't think he's a terrible person, but he's just got that. Yeah, that ruthless competitive thing going all the time, right? Yeah, you can't shut it off. Yeah.
I think people like it, though, in a way. Like, I think it gives him an edge over, say, LeBron James when people talk about who's the greatest of all time. They sort of like the ruthless animal. Jordan is, like, a more impressive figure to them than a nice guy like LeBron.
Mm.
You know, they don't want to say a nice guy is better than the ruthless guy, you know. Like I also think Jordan, there's a strong case. I would also think he's the greatest of all time, separate from that, but I think it helps his case. People just like that sort of, you know, that image that gets their adrenaline going, like, so he's ruthless and he's cold-blooded and he's a killer. That's sort of not LeBron's image. That's like, I've said that about Tyson. There's sort of a bump for Mike Tyson right now online. Have you noticed it? Like he released like a 5-second video of him hitting pads. And now all the kids of today are like, oh my God, he could still, I want to see him. I want to see him fight a top 10 boxer. I don't want to see him come back and fight. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
He hit pads. He looked like a beast hitting the pads, but I bet 15 years ago he looked like a beast and he was losing to journeyman. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's just craziness that people think.
I mean, these guys today are so big, Dan. Tyson Fury is just a big man. I don't think Tyson could beat him in his prime if he could somehow show up at age 22 right now.
Size differences are huge.
It's huge, yeah.
Tyson couldn't beat – people don't like this. There's sort of this Tyson cult forming over the last few years that's a little strange that it's like we were there. We saw the fights. Like he couldn't beat Holyfield. He tried twice.
Couldn't beat him.
And he couldn't – and he was like 30 when he fought him. You know, people are like, oh, he was way past his prime. I'm like, he was not way past his prime.
I think Holyfield's older, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, Tyson was like 29 the first fight, maybe, or something.
But how can you say the younger guys is past his prime? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
So it's sort of, they're like, oh, prime Tyson would be.
Wasn't a gigantic guy either. You know what I mean? Like his frame. I mean, he weighed maybe 220 or something, but he kind of built himself up to that
weight. Boxer. He was a great boxer, a great counterpuncher, and he punished Tyson.
He started as a cruiserweight, Holyfield did. Yeah. And then he went up to heavyweight. Yeah.
But I think I've mentioned this before, at least to you. I don't know if it's on the podcast, that people like a Tyson.
Oh, they do.
It's the same idea of liking a Jordan over LeBron. Like they like Tyson. He's just, he was so scary and he'd come out and he'd knock people's heads off. And Michael Spinks basically gave up out of fear and he's killing everyone. And then they don't want to acknowledge that people don't like to acknowledge just technique. Like, it's too complicated. Like, no one likes to say...
Dan, you just hit the nail on the head. Too complicated.
Yeah.
Tyson just simplifies everything. Oh, he's scary and hits hard. He wins. That's it. Don't make me think about stuff, you know? I think it was Mayweather's trainer, his uncle or something. He's got a famous line where he says, most people don't know shit about boxing. And, of course, it's the truth, right?
Yeah.
90% of the fans don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Or MMA or jiu-jitsu.
Probably,
I don't know if there are jiu-jitsu fans that... I bet it's a more knowledgeable fan base just because there's not a mass of people showing up, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't imagine there's jiu-jitsu fans who don't do jiu-jitsu themselves, right? Doesn't happen, right?
I bet that you could have a whole tournament with almost no one in the stands that's just a fan. Probably no one.
I don't think. No.
But I've been to many live MMA.
Somebody's mom or something.
Live MMA events, and it's a bunch of savages. Like, there's very few people there that know what the sport is, what's going on. Like at a UFC event.
Yeah.
Like, they just want to, you know, I think.
I'll never go to a live UFC event again.
Most of the time, most of the fan base, I think you can attest, they'd like to see, they'd like to see drunk fights, or, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They'd like to see two drunks come out and wail on each other. They'd be happier than.
Definitely.
Than a technical, two grapplers that were being technical.
Yeah.
You know?
I think so.
I've been at events, too, where it's like, you know, each ticket's like 300 and up. So people are paying their money.
Crazy.
And I've seen it like, you know, a fight for a belt, an incredibly technical fight going on in the ring, and a fight breaks out in the stands. Everyone turns. Like, people with like ringside seats are like turning to watch the fight in the stands, you know, like, and you hear like a roar go up, and I'm like, they like it more.
They like it more.
Yeah.
I don't know. Oh, I stumbled upon some Twitter account where these guys, they somehow get a hold of street fights and then they commentate them. It's just, it sounds like two guys and they're short. They're like a minute long. And they're the funniest thing going. I must have sent you one.
I don't remember.
There was one of some fight in Brooklyn or something just last week. And I saw it on a lot of social media.
Was that the one of them sounded like Jeff Goldblum?
The guys commentating?
Yeah.
These sound like two young black guys. I don't know.
Okay. It's different.
And the one guy was tall and skinny. They were calling him Liam Neeson or something. He's like, throw these kicks. And the other guy has like,
I think
a
it was
wife
the same fight
on.
I saw, but
yeah,
a different one.
It was all over the place. Yeah. Probably a bunch of people commentated on it. Yeah. It was entertaining because nobody really got hurt, mercifully, because they were both not. One guy was a little bit more effective at fighting than the other guy. Yeah. Yeah, card of shit show, yeah.
But I thought of one more thing about this. Is now Brady won so much that people are sort of reluctantly saying he's probably the greatest of all time. But I think one thing that worked against him for a long time was his greatness involved quickly reading defenses and putting the ball in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not, people don't like that. It's technique. They don't like to be like, you should have seen me. Like, no one wants to sit there.
Subtle technique, Dan.
Yeah.
It's non-visible technique. Like, he can think well.
You don't want to sit your grandson on your knee and be like, I saw him. He was like at least a quarter second faster than any other quarterback at sizing up the mismatch in the way the defense was lining up. And, you know, they want to say he could throw the ball through a brick wall.
Yeah.
He could throw it 100 yards and he could run, a 4.340. And they want to say, like, I saw a superhero. And that's what they
do.
So relating it to Tyson, they want to be like, he was a superhero. He would knock your head off. No one wanted to get in the ring with him. He was a terror. They don't want to be like, well.
They want obvious physical dominance, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of not a superhero to be like, well, Klitschko would probably keep him at range with a jab and.
Right.
And, tie him up. And tie him up when he came in. And so probably Klitschko would win.
Probably would happen.
Yeah. So, and then you saw Tyson when Holyfield wasn't scared. He sort of crumbled. He started biting him.
He crumbled.
You know?
He totally crumbled. Lennox Lewis handled Tyson pretty handily too, right? Yeah.
And even when he lost to Buster Douglas, which was the shock of the all-time sporting event shock of my life, it was because, if you remember the story, Buster Douglas's mom had just died.
Yeah.
And he was just like in sort of a depression, I guess, and was like, screw it. Like, he just didn't care.
Yeah. He lost all his self-consciousness. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever, and just went in and fought.
Emotional state.
Tyson started getting, you know, like.
I think Tyson was also like.
Yeah. He was like partying.
Yeah. And, completely out of shape.
And he thought he was indestructible. He bought his own hype at that time too.
Yeah.
So he was not in optimal shape. I'm sure I'm confident Tyson would have done well in a rematch, but.
He almost knocked him out. He put him down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember watching it. It was like, you know, this looks like Tyson is about to be knocked out, but I can't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, is he's just going to, I remember some later round that you're talking about, seventh round, somewhere in there, like Tyson knocked him down.
Yeah.
And it sort of seemed like, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
Like, okay, now everything's
back to normal.
He can't really win. Then Buster Douglas got up and it was like, wait a minute, what's happening? Is he going to lose? Because again, people like a superhero. They don't like technique. They don't like, you know.
They don't want to spend energy.
So now there's
thinking
this madness. Like, Tyson's got this gray beard. He's in his 50s, and people are like, I don't want to see I saw someone writing a sports column that was like, I don't want to see him just come back to fight some like exhibition nonsense match. I want to see him fight a top 10 guy. And I'm like, you're
who the hell would say that? Yeah, that's crazy.
Idiot. Like,
I see a lot of people on social media are calling out, like, I'll fight Mike Tyson. I saw just today Ken Shamrock is ready to fight Mike Tyson.
Well, just think all the MMA guys should be volunteering to do it because of the payday.
Right.
You know,
probably their best payday they could ever get, right? Yeah.
And, you know, it might happen because then Tyson, that's someone he could beat in a boxing match. You know, it's someone he'd have a chance at, an actual non-boxer.
They do if they box, they beat all those. I mean, Ken Shamrock, he'd destroy him.
Yeah, but even like Stipe or John Jones or someone
I don't
boxing
know.
Match, it's very hard to be like, I've never been in a boxing match, now I got to box Tyson.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
So, that, you know what I mean? There could be a draw to that.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, but that Last Dance was cool. So, Dan, I'm still reading this book, The Fighter's Mind.
Fighter's Mind. This may be the book that's given us the most podcasts.
It has.
That we've.
Yeah, maybe sometime we should call Sam Sheridan. I mean, he really did an excellent job in this book, man. He picked good people and he extracted good stuff out of every guy he talked to, man. Really happy with that book. So I read, I'll get to my notes, Dan. So I had a chapter about Frank Shamrock, which is good, but some of the stuff we sort of already covered, so I didn't want to bring it up.
Right.
He was pretty successful. He had one thing that I'm sure anybody who trains in jiu-jitsu I would think know about, but maybe we should mention it. This is, I don't know if this applies anywhere else in life, Dan. Maybe you can tell me if you can think of somewhere else. So you should train with three different levels of people. Somebody who is better than you, somebody who's more or less at your level, and somebody who is not as good as you. And that's, if you have that combination, you're going to have your optimal development.
I think we've said that, right?
We must have, right?
Yeah.
John Danaher, the famous coach from Henzo's, he says you should have like 85%. You should be training with people you're better than.
It's hard at first, but
it's impossible at first, Dan. Right? I don't know if that's exactly correct, but I would. How can I argue with John Danaher? The guy's like a genius of jiu-jitsu. He's so successful.
Yeah, that gets easier to do as you go on. I think for a lot of us, it's going to be hard to find 85% of people that you're better than.
I did. Did I tell you how I really learned how to triangle choke from my guard? I trained with a guy who was smaller than me, weaker than me, and way less experienced. And then I could, you know, practice my setups and I think I was a nice guy about it. I was probably a total dick about it. I don't know. I try to be a nice person, Dan, but I tend to generate enough hate from people that I'm probably unwittingly being a jerk. But I didn't think I was a jerk with him, but it helped me, that training, a lot. So does that correspond to anything else in life, those three levels?
I can't think of it. I can't think of the first time I got a triangle successfully.
Yeah?
And this is going to sound bad.
Okay.
It was on a woman. But what was happening?
Were you bigger,
like,
and stronger than her?
I think maybe
more experience,
a slight edge. Yeah, I had all of it. It wasn't a good. Yeah, nice. I couldn't catch a triangle on one of the better women.
Okay,
so like I was, but it was one of those things. She kind of, I suddenly was like, hey, I'm in a spot to get a triangle.
Nice.
So I'm like, let me just see if I can just finish it. You know, like, let me just do it. But then it was one of those things where...
You're an eco-opportunity guy, right? You're open-minded, progressive. Yeah.
I think I was just like, let me just... So I got the tap and I'm like... And then I think, if I remember right...
Was that when you jumped up and ran around the mat with your hands
in your
air?
Face? Yeah, I was like, did you see that? Try. But if I remember right, I think I was like, thought I was like off in the corner and just kind of got the tap. I was like, oh,
quietly.
Yeah, quietly.
Yeah.
And then I think like between the next and the next roll, Marcelo came up and was like,
so Coach Marcelo.
Yeah. Yeah. Was just sort of like, yeah, maybe go a little easier on that. Like, you know, like, I was like, oh, he saw that. You know, like, it's just like, oh, you know, maybe with the women, you can just sort of off your back. And I'm like, stop it. I always roll properly. This one time, I was, the way I felt, I'm like, the one time I get the triangle,
You get the spotted.
One time
out.
I get spotted and called out. I'm
God
like,
damn it.
Like 95% every other role.
No, I will attest, Dan. You train very appropriately.
Yes,
definitely.
Thank you.
Okay. Now the next chapter I came across was Josh Waitzkin, who I've talked about, I'm sure, many times on here. Do you remember who that guy was?
I do not.
He was the person who the movie and the book Searching for Bobby Fischer was written about.
Right.
So he was originally a young chess prodigy. Then he got a Tai Chi or something. And then he became one of Marcelo Garcia's black belts. I think he might be a partner with him in that academy or something. He wrote the book, The Art of Learning. Excellent book. If you're interested in anything, jiu-jitsu or learning anything, that is really a cool book. So here's some of his ideas. One of them, the first thing I wrote down, Dan, is he said he learned to channel his emotions instead of blocking them, which I don't know exactly. And he was in chess and he would get emotional and then he tried to block his emotions. Like sometimes we advocate on here that you should be more like Mr. Spock.
Right.
But I think maybe if you're starting to try to block your emotions, you're losing that kind of cat energy. You're tightening up maybe, and you're distracting yourself maybe.
I put it another way. What if you can't? Do you know what I mean? Like, what if you can't? You know, it's like, be like Mr. Spock's all well and good.
But what if you can't?
Yeah. What if your rush of anger or adrenaline or fear or whatever it is, then what do you do?
Right.
So I don't think they're exclusive. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think you try to not... There's certain circumstances, like you try not to be emotional about what if I lose? What if I try to not worry about that stuff? But then what do you do?
Well, Frank Shamrock had emotions. A good point, which I've heard other places too. Fear and excitement feel similar in your body. So if you're starting to feel a stress response, try to, you know, convince yourself you're being excited. You're excited. You're not afraid.
You know,
put a positive connotation on sort of the corporal feeling that you're getting at the time, which would be, I guess, a form of channeling your emotions, right? Now, the other thing, Josh Waitzkin, I think he was talking about chess players at this, but this might correspond to something else. He would observe people in life. Like, so the example he gets, he goes to a chess tournament in the Bahamas or something, and everyone's at the beach, and all of a sudden there's a rainstorm, and then he watched how the players handle getting caught in a downpour. Some would stay out there and laugh with their hands out. Others would cover their head and run like maniacs. So his interpretation with the people that didn't want to get wet were sort of, he described them as control freaks, and the other people were more experimental. And, you know, you might call them in the Big Five profile. One is more closed and one is way more open. So then he could sort of intuit their style of play based on how he perceived their openness or closedness.
Right. And so in athletics or jiu-jitsu in particular, you'd have a lot more data points generally than watching them in a rainstorm. You can tell there are some people
that have a style of jiu-jitsu that's more controlled and methodical, and some have a more wide, freewheeling, scrambling type. So the obvious thing is if somebody is closed and methodical, you try to drag them into a more freewheeling environment in your match in order to get an advantage, and vice versa. And then the other really cool idea he had was, this applied in chess. I don't know where else it would apply. He would say, a lot of times in chess, there's two options where, you know, it's your move. You can either kind of go in this direction or that direction. So he would set it up that he would give them, you can go wide open over here. Let's say you're a closed player, or you can go more closed over here. But he knew the more closed route wasn't as good for the guy. But their natural inclination was to head toward the closed thing. So he would kind of use their own inclination to sort of trap them. What do you think? That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, you have to be really good at chess or jiu-jitsu to sort of make the best use of that at that level. But you could use it at a basic level too, like you were saying, just try to get people not playing the game they're comfortable with.
Now, here's an idea that wasn't in the book, but I don't think it was, but something that I just realized. I was talking to my son Rory about this today. I find that people, they can come up with a negative belief based on very little evidence. In other words, somebody will try to pass my guard maybe 5 times and fail, and then they're like, oh, I can't pass his guard. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly precisely what you mean.
But I just find it fascinating that most of us, we don't need much negative evidence, and we'll create a very firm belief, which is not rational, right? I guess it's goes back to that. We're trying to save energy. We don't want to waste our time trying to pass somebody's guard 100 times when we know it's not possible. So we'll try five. Five is good. I'm out.
Yeah.
But that doesn't serve us, especially if we're trying to develop. So if we can somehow, you know, hack that tendency and convince ourselves, like you said, Kenny Florian was like that, like, oh, it hasn't worked, but the next time I got him here, you know. Yeah.
Or if you could analyze, say, why didn't it work? Like, how do you stop it? Right.
That's
like,
always good, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do now, Dan, as much. Well, that's kind of like our theme maybe today is this energy side and the technical side. So in the one sense, the technical side is, why did he stop it? Oh, he got his knee inside here or something. But the energy side would be, but I'm going to get him next time. You know, right. When you have this sense of positive expectation. So if you have the energy and the technical, that's probably the best approach. So then this, now back to Josh Waitzkin, he was talking about some opponents he had were so sensitive to his movements that they could detect any feint that he was going to do. So then he started to just think his feints instead of actually doing his feints. And somehow that had an effect on his opponents and throw them off. I thought that was a little out there, but it sounds interesting. What do you think?
It sounds out there, but it's at such a level of chess that's so far beyond my third grade level of chess that, like, you know what I mean? Like, I can't assess it. Like, maybe there's some reality to it. Like, you're thinking about it and your opponent's watching the pieces you're looking at and can tell from your pause what you're thinking. Like, it might not be pure like voodoo, you know? It might be like...
Well, I have a poker story, Dan. Do you want to hear my poker story?
Sure.
So I used to be a pretty successful poker player as a young man, and I used to go every Sunday night to Rico Paolini's Poker Palace.
I didn't. Yeah. This is brand new information.
Is it?
Me. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a home game. I was, by decades, the youngest guy in the game. I mean, I was probably 19 years old, and these guys were all like in their 70s or something, and they're the most grizzled poker veterans ever, and good. You know what I mean? Yeah. These guys, they hated to lose a nickel, never mind a dollar, you know? So it was great games and a lot of fun. So Rico would have a spread of food and he would rake a couple of chips out of the pot. It was a very sophisticated game. Butchie was the guy who was like, I don't know what you call him, like the waiter boy or whatever. So Butchie would get you whatever you want, a beer, sandwich,
Rico's Poker Palace.
Rico Paolini's Poker Palace. May you rest in peace. Rico was awesome, the greatest guy. I won one of the largest hand. I think I won the largest hand ever there, playing 7-card stud. I got 4 fives somehow, and somebody else had a full house. Somebody else had a flush. I think I won. I think $1,500 something in that one hand. And I think I took my girlfriend to Mexico after I won that or something. Yeah, and he made a little plaque, and I found that when I was moving a year or so ago, and it's like he had the 4 fives and a whole thing, and he put it together like. You know, like you would, you know, glue macaroni for your mom's Mother's Day card or something. He made this little plaque.
And you must have had some, that's the skill there is to get people to keep betting and thinking, not getting suspicious that you're like,
well,
you've got something.
Here's what I did. So I was in there, I was having my wins, having my losses. I mean, these guys were tough, smart poker players. And it wasn't No Limit. It was Limit Poker. So you got to be kind of conservative. It's tough to bluff. It's tricky. So then I came up with this idea. I just basically did method acting. So I would get my cards. So 7-card stud, 2 cards down, 1 over. Then I would look at my cards, and then I would pretend that my cards were something else. And I would hold that image in my mind completely.
It's like the chess player, right?
Completely. I'd be like, oh my God, I get 3 threes. And I wouldn't I would just think it. And then I'd be like, I don't want them to know I have 3-3. And it was so successful, Dan. I went on this insane winning streak. And this one old guy got so pissed at me. He was spitting because they couldn't freaking figure out what I was doing. And that was it. No matter what I had, I would just imagine I had some other hand. And I didn't always imagine I had 3 aces. I would imagine anything. And then I would just start behaving like I had that. And like I would just really believe it. And it was very effective. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty
cool. I don't know how the hell that relates to anything else, but power of belief or something, right? Okay, now back to cat energy. So Waitzkin has this other, I really liked what he talked about here. So he said, imagine a cat versus a mouse, right? The cat spots the mouse turns around, spots the cat. They're both freeze, right? It's a moment of great tension, right? But the mouse's tension is like a heavy, debilitating tension. Like he's either going to live or frickin' die. The cat is either going to have a little snack or whatever. So the consequences are completely different. So the cat can be in the moment and be serene with it, at peace with that tension. And the mouse is in the moment and he can only stay there for so long. And then he finally can't take it anymore. And he tries to escape and then the cat pounces. You know what I mean? So it's of course only really a metaphor, but
I like that metaphor though, too, when you've, cause it's related to channeling your emotions, right? It's like you feel that tension, especially say you're competing or even in the gym. So I never get tense in the gym, but some people do.
Or even in, you go to buy a car in negotiation and there's like,
and you, so you feel the tension.
Yeah.
Can you rework it in your mind to more the cat tension than the mouse tension? Like, I'm not scared for my life here.
Can I be at peace with it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm at tense, more like the cat, like something's going to happen, but it's not like I'm not, it's like the mouse is like, there's going to be disaster or not. Right.
I may die.
Yeah. I'm going to die or just live, you know, or neutral the disaster.
Right.
And can you interpret that same tension as like something good to neutral? That's where the cat is.
Yeah.
And that's really, so I think in jiu-jitsu, a lot of times there's that tension and people feel it like the mouse, like I'm going to die. Like this is going to be awful. I could get submitted. Can you take that same tension and be the cat where you're like, something good might happen or
and that
neutral.
Mouse tension drains your energy because you're going to make a Herculean effort to, for 10 or 20 seconds to escape and save your life. And then you're done. You don't have any more energy. Where the cat, he can stay there all day just staring at you. So, you know, I was training with my son once and we were training mount escapes. So I'm on the bottom. He's on top of mount. And, you know, he's trying to attack me and I'm trying to do my escape. And then he was doing a really good job of sort of like, so escape Dan is I got to get him back in my guard. But he's kind of like moving to side control, knee on stomach. And then I'm escaping. Now I'm trying to escape that position. And then he's maybe trying to grab my neck. And then I started to feel a little bit of that mouse tension, like, because it was like I wasn't getting submitted, but I wasn't out yet. You know what I mean? The tension was still on. And then I had my arms in good position. Then I had to realize, I'm like, wait a minute. There's no threat of submission here. I'm still good. And then I worked my way out. So I found my cat energy again. And then I escaped. And I didn't waste energy. Where if I had that mouse energy, I still might have escaped, but I probably would have spent a lot of energy and put myself behind, you know?
It's brutal in stand-up and boxing too, because there's times, especially when in the early days when I box with people that could hurt me, I'd feel like, why am I so tired? You know what I mean?
It's
like after a few rounds, it's exhausting to feel like, and you don't even notice it. I'm not standing there like this, but
the sense
at
of
some level, you must be
disaster,
like, there must be some kind of tension in my muscles that's just exhausting.
Well, your nervous system is just like the hair on the back of your neck is standing up. Yeah. You're just waiting for some calamity to hit you. Yeah, it's exhausting. Yeah, fascinating. Right. So he made a further point about that, but it's basically the same thing. The more serene and present you can be, then the more success you can have.
Yeah, we've said that a lot.
Yeah.
So that's a different way of putting something we've said a lot.
And he basically, so he's also advocating, Josh Waitzkin is to sort of try to practice that serene presence in everyday life. So then when you need it in a certain moment, your nervous system is used to having that kind of serene presence. Pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Now, the only other thing he had is, I don't know what you think about this, Dan. Let's see if I can explain this properly. He was talking about two ways to beat a player who's got a certain style.
Is this chess or jiu-jitsu?
I think it's all of it, yeah. Or he did Tai Chi or something, whatever, how that they do competitive Tai Chi. You can squelch his game. It's just like, we're not going to allow you to start your game, you know, whatever it is. Like if you're this free-willing jiu-jitsu guy, we're just going to bog you down, tie you down, put you in close guard, just slow everything down. Or if he's this freewheeling guy, we're going to make it even more freewheeling than he's used to. What do you think of that?
Right. I think that would depend on your strengths, right? Like,
yeah, you just can't.
I can't be more freewheeling than him. Then that's not the way to go, right?
I totally agree. You know? I think that'd be really hard to accomplish, right?
Yeah.
If you could do that, you're probably going to beat him no matter what happens.
Yeah, if you
anyways.
Could either squash him or be more freewheeling than him, that means you're just better. Right? that means I can do whatever I want and I'm going to win.
Right.
Right?
I think
that's
so.
What it sounds like. It seems so. Like you have to pick which one of those is
well, maybe
the way
he's
to
saying
go.
If you can't squelch him, then try to push the pace even faster than he's used to going.
Yeah, and maybe surprise him with it.
Yeah. Or if you can't go faster than him, then you have to squelch him.
Yeah.
Hmm. I don't know. Interesting stuff, though. But Josh Waitzkin's interesting guy. Get his book, The Art of Learning. Get this book, The Fighter's Mind. It's been great.
And maybe we should check out that book from the 70s.
The Inner Game of Tennis. Yeah.
Inner Game of Tennis.
Yeah. Tim Galway.
You haven't read it, right? So
I've not read it.
We don't know if it's going to apply or not, but the idea
I think
sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we just captured the idea anyways.
Yeah.
Like finding some way to transcend your self-consciousness. You know, I think, you know, I've been working with Mark Delagrati at Sitya Tong, and I don't know how long I've been working with him now, but, you know, I was working with another trainer for a while. And I think the other guy was technically excellent, but he wasn't addressing the energy side. Then I started working with Mark, and he's sort of a master at both. And it really allowed me to break through sort of a plateau because of focusing on that sort of energy, you know? And it's awesome, yeah. But it takes a special teacher, I guess. See, the thing is, Dan, I think if you only focus on the technical, you can hit a plateau. Like, all the technique can get you to a certain height. But then if you don't have the energy right, you keep sticking with the technique and it just like hardens that plateau. And it's just like you're just freaking stuck. And you're like, if I could only turn my hip over more. And it's just it's not helping
right.
at all. And then if you just can get a little of the energy going, you just have a major breakthrough and then you can go on a run of development. So it's funny. It's not something that I would normally embrace. It seems kind of woo-woo, but I think there's a lot of value to it. Definitely. What else? Oh, I want to have another shout out to a super fan, Rick Shea. Danny left me a message, trains jiu-jitsu with us. He said he loves the podcast and he wants to hear more about the Jerry Seinfeld calendar. He's like, you haven't talked about that in a while. And Rick, unfortunately, my calendar is sitting on my door. I haven't made a mark on it in months.
Well, I have great news for Rick.
All right.
I broke the calendar back out.
Nice.
Like it had been in storage for the quarantine.
Yeah.
And I was just like eating and being a pig and not, and I was like, I got to do something.
Okay.
And followed my own advice and broke it back out just a couple weeks ago.
2 weeks ago or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
has it helped?
It's helped a little in that I've started working out. The eating is not good.
Oh, I just got a hamstring. Crap.
Pulled a hammy.
Sitting here.
That's the thing.
Oh man.
Podcasts is very physical.
Whew.
It's very, very physical. People don't realize that haven't done it.
That's the first. We 80 some odd podcasts since the first time I pulled a hamstring. Damn.
Have you ever pulled one on the mat?
When you have the kind of speed I have, Dan, you can just rip the muscle right off the bone.
This is what I'm saying though. People think that, you know, they're like jiu-jitsu strenuous. I'd say podcasting is up there.
It's right up there.
It's right up there. But anyway, to Rick.
Yeah.
I broke the calendar back out.
Nice.
I'm still not eating right, but working on it. I know I'm 2 weeks
out. You're
doing
pretty good. Today you told me you were 184, right?
Yeah.
That's not bad. I'm at 182, which is, I consider, 4 pounds over my training weight. So I don't feel that bad about that.
Yeah. I know I need 2 weeks to get back where I was.
Nice.
But 2 weeks of like starving, which I'm not quite willing to do yet. But
right. Well, I think we got to wrap it up. That was a long one today.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody. I can't wait to see you guys back at the Academy. We'll be there soon. Thanks so much.